You are listening to the Pronk Pop Show, presented by Raymond Thomas Pronk, the People's Paladin Pronk, propagating faith, family, friends, freedom first. Broadcasted by Renaissance Radio, Radiating Reason, and KDUX Web Radio. Podcasted by PronkPops.wordpress.com and KDUXWebRadio.wordpress.com. You are listening to KDUX Web Radio, broadcasting live from Richland College in Dallas, Texas. We're the voice of Richland College. My name is Raymond Thomas Pronk, the presenter of the Pronk Pop Show. Views expressed on this show are my own, unless otherwise stated, and do not reflect the opinion of KDUX Web Radio, Richland College, or the Dallas County Community College District. Welcome to the Pronk Pop Show. Normally on Fridays I have a long show, and by long I mean 2 hours typically. But today's show is going to be a little shorter than that because we have been trying to complete the newspaper. I'm not involved with that anymore, but on Fridays the staff, the Richland Chronicle staff, tries to put the paper to bed. And normally that means 9, 10, 11 o'clock in the evening before they're done. But they put a lot of effort into it yesterday. So yesterday I did and actually did a longer show than I anticipated. So today's show is going to be a little bit shorter. I'm not exactly sure. Probably at least 30 minutes. It could go as long as 45, but I'm going to very much try to keep it to that. I'm going to really have no choice because when they give me the signal to shut down, I got to shut down. So I wanted to give you that heads up. And before I forget, this is the Labor Day weekend, and for students and staff, the campus will be totally closed at 11 o'clock tonight and will not be open again until 6 o'clock on Tuesday. So none of the computer labs are going to be open during the weekend. Usually they are on Saturday and Sundays. No, the campus is shut tight. You can walk on campus, but you're not going to be able to get into any of the buildings. Now, with that out of the way, those announcements, I really want to cover two stories, and they're really very much related. And that is the jobs report that came out this morning at 8:30 Eastern Standard Time in Washington, D.C., as well as the big anticipation as to what exactly is the Federal Reserve going to do with the federal funds target rate in their meeting on the 16th. Well, my guess is, I don't know. I'd flip a coin would be one way. I've said on this show several times that the Federal Reserve should have been increasing that rate several years ago and really let the market determine it. Instead, we have what I call a command and control Federal Reserve trying to set the price of money or the interest rate by the federal funds target rate. Now, the federal funds rate is the 24-hour rate that banks when they loan money to each another, and that has been at 25 basis points. It's also commonly referred to as the near zero interest rate. And if you go to my blog for the show, and for new listeners, the way you listen to this show, I'm streaming right now, but most of my listeners, I'd say almost all of my listeners, listen to the show by either streaming the podcast or downloading the podcast and listening at their convenience. So you go to prongpops.wordpress.com. That's prongpops, prongpops.wordpress.com. At the very top, you'll see a photograph of me in the studio. And it's an old photograph because I've actually lost some weight, ladies and gentlemen. But I'm not going to retake that photo until I've successfully completed my diet in roughly a year from today. And then I will replace that photograph. But at the very top, you'll have that photograph as well as some information about me. And below that, I have links to the recent 60 to 80 shows. And today's show is 527. And it should be posted no later than 5 o'clock Tuesday. If I have time and if the computer lab is open, I might be able to post it this evening. I'm going to try, but again, if the computer lab is shut down tight because of the holidays, and sometimes they let the lab out early when we're approaching a holiday, I won't be able to do this until first thing Tuesday morning. So bear with me. I normally like to post the show that day, usually in the evening, but because of the holidays, I might not have access to a computer, so sorry about that. You're going to have to wait for the show on Tuesday. But I do provide you some information, and for those that are new, I provide for every show some of the information I looked at, whether it's photographs, graphs, cartoons, related to the news stories I'm covering, as well as articles. And usually when I do the labor report, I simply did not have the time, but I will make the time to add some more information, or maybe if I get lucky, even tonight, I give you some information that I pull from the Bureau of Labor Statistics Employment Survey, and they publish the Department of Labor and specifically its Bureau of Labor Statistics, the BLS. And if you're interested in this, go to bls.gov. It publishes a lot of information. Very good information, both in chart form and in table form. And usually I pull out about a dozen key statistics. This time I simply didn't have the time. And this is really the first labor jobs report that I've been able to do in, I think, 2 months. For various reasons, either I was sick or could not get to it. This is the first time I've done a job report, I think, in at least 2 months. In other words, about 3 months ago. So what's the big headline today in the news? Well, you're going to hear in the newscast. This is the one thing you're definitely going to hear in the newscast, especially the major networks. The unemployment rate plunged, dropped to 5.1%. And remember, that's the headline, so-called headline unemployment rate, more precisely labeled or as the U3 rate. Well, it did go down, and there were 173,000 jobs created, and that's based on a survey, and that's non-farm payroll jobs. That was definitely below expectations. Economists every month make predictions, and there's a panel of them, and I believe they were predicting about 220,000, so this is definitely below. However, and this is an important point, usually the August numbers understate the jobs that were created, and they've been wrong many, 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 many times. So, and this is the August, it's really the August report that has this problem. I don't know what's going on. Maybe a lot of people are taking vacations. Who knows? But the job, you got to take these job numbers with a grain of salt, and they probably will be revised, in this case, upwards. But what's the bad news? What is really behind these numbers that's getting a lot of attention? And it's in the headline for this post. There are now 94 million, and this is a record, 94 million Americans not in the labor force. In other words, they're not working. Now, you need to understand, because some people, I think, overemphasize this. I think this is an important number. Don't misunderstand me. And it needs to be focused in on, and I'm going to focus in on this. But not every one of that 94 million truly wants to work. There are housewives that are staying home with their children. There are people going to college. There's a host, long list of reasons why people decide not to be in the labor force. And there's 94 million of them. And the labor force, I have, this is where I'm at a disadvantage, because normally I would have this number. The labor force, as far as I'm concerned today, should be 160 million plus. Now, the Department of Labor BLS number, I'm trying to see if I can pull it out, and I'm not being able to spot what their labor force number is. It's available. I'm guessing here, I'm willing to bet their number is under 160 million. Probably 157, 158. But a fairly, I think, conservative estimate is that the labor force should be at least 160 million. Now, here's the important point. This, I'm going to give you a wide estimate, because people differ as to this number. I would say a minimum of $10 million, upwards of $20 million, and it could be higher, of that $94 million would take a job if they could find one. Because a good portion of the of that $94 million are discouraged workers, long-term discouraged workers, people that would like to work if they could find a good paying job. And they have left the labor force. And because they have left the labor force, they're not counted. That's the reason the unemployment rate dropped to 5.1%, because those not in the labor force increased. That's not good, folks, because we literally have at least 10 million or more people, and I think it's closer to 20 million, that if they could find a permanent full-time job, would go back into the labor force. They're simply not being counted, and that's why you got to be very, very careful with government statistics. I understand these numbers, and I understand they have a wide errors. So you got to take them with a grain of salt. They are going to be revised. But what do you truly need to understand? Here's how I approach it. What does it take in terms of new jobs being created? Non-farm payroll jobs, a monthly figure. What's the rule of thumb? It's not only my rule of thumb. Many economists use this rule of thumb. You need to create about 300,000 jobs. Now, some will say a little bit less. Some will say a little bit more. But why do they say that? First of all, every month, you have what's called new entrants to the labor force. These are people looking for their first time. They're entering the labor market for the first time. That's what they call new entrants. And these are high school graduates as well as high school dropouts, and college graduates as well as college dropouts. They're primarily teenagers and people in their early 20s. And remember, they're going for their first job. And you get a range of estimates. Remember, all these numbers are estimates, and that needs to be emphasized really many, many times. All the numbers I'm giving you here are estimates. They didn't count people. They literally, that's impossible, and it's too costly. They don't do that. They do samples or surveys, and they both go door to door in the household survey. They also make telephone calls. And there are two surveys. There's the household survey, where you will get from that information the unemployment number, as well as the business entity or employer's survey. And let me back up. The household survey, usually it's 60,000 households. And that number does vary a little, but that's about how many households they go to, and they do change them over time. And then you have the, what I call the entity survey, the employer survey, the establishment survey. And that is based on employers. And there, it's over 400,000. And last time I checked this, it was about 470,000, 480,000. I'm not exactly sure today what the number is, but it's a much, much more, much larger population. And it's from that survey that you'll get the non-farm payroll numbers in terms of the number of jobs being created. You also get a number, and they don't agree, from the household survey about number of jobs being created, because in the household survey you'll pick up some businesses that are one-man operations, the self-employed. Now, I'm not trying to confuse you, but I want to emphasize all these numbers are estimates, and the estimates vary, and they have errors in them, and depending on who you talk to, you're going to get a range of estimates as to, for example, how many new entrants come to the labor force every month. Usually, the typical range is between 130,000 and 150,000. If you want to reduce, in other words, every month, new people are entering the labor market for the first time. Now, some economists will say that number should be even higher, 160,000, which I tend to agree with. Some will say it's as low as 100,000. But the typical range is between 130,000 and 150,000. So I caution you, whoever you talk to, and I don't make an estimate of this, but I know I've seen the information, the opinions, and I want you to be aware of that. Now, in addition to that, that's just to, and this is the important point, that's just to keep pace with population growth, the demographic growth of our population. Because as our population grows in size, and people have children, obviously, over time, you're going to have more and more people enter the labor force. And that's what what happens over time. So all these numbers over decades will change, and you need to keep that in mind. You want to know what the trends are, what the typical range is, what are the rather low end of the range, the high end of the range. Now, to keep the example simple in that 300,000 a month rule of thumb, you need 150,000. I'm going to use 150,000 new entrants. Some will say that's too high. Some will say it's too low, but it's in the ballpark. Now, in addition to that, that's just to keep pace with population growth. You need to reduce the unemployment rate by a tenth of a percent, you need approximately another 150,000 jobs. So if you add the two numbers together, and that's why I'm trying to keep this simple, you need approximately 300,000 jobs created per month. That's a big number. And if you scroll down, you'll see a chart. It's improvement in employment is the title of the chart. It's right below the bubble being popped. I'm going to see if I can get a bigger image of it. Doesn't look like I can. But this chart goes from 2005 through 2015. And it shows you seasonally adjusted non-farm payroll in thousands. Now, you'll notice when we're in a recession, which we were, and really starting in 2008, continuing through the first half of 2009, corporations, companies, employers were laying off people. So we had negative numbers. And that's why you see those negative numbers between zero and 1 month, it was over 800,000. That's not good. That's when we're truly in a recession, and we were in a recession. And the National Bureau of Economic Research, which times recessions, it's a committee that the National Bureau of Economic Research has set up, a professional economist. One of them happened to be my professor in graduate school, Robert Hull. I'm sure he's totally forgot about me. But I remember him. He's chairman of that committee, or at least was the last time I checked. And they have a committee of economists that periodically they'll try to make a determination. Is the economy either entering a recession or entering a recovery? Well, they made a determination several years ago that the economy the recession started in December of 2007. And according to them, it ended in June of 2009. So over 6 years ago, the recession ended. And you can see the impact of a recession on employment in terms of those negative numbers. Those are quite large numbers. Now, it doesn't mean we haven't had 1 month or two or three even of negative numbers. And these numbers are revised numbers. If you look at it, on average, and I'm just eyeballing it here, but you can see it, the number of non-farm payroll jobs that have been created is around 200,000. That's below 300,000, folks. And that doesn't surprise me. Maybe it surprises you. It doesn't mean we haven't had one or two quarters that it was actually above 400,000. I think in 1 month we were approaching 500,000. But generally, since the recovery started in July of 2009, about 200,000 jobs a month. Sometimes less, sometimes more. And that's why I try to give you this rule of thumb. If you want to consistently reduce the unemployment rate, you got to create 300,000 jobs. Not just for 1 month. 1 month does not a trend make. You need to do this consistently. And that typically requires the economy growing between 3 and 4%, approximately 3.5%. The economy is not growing at 3%. That's the problem. The economy is growing somewhere between 2 and 2.5%. It's stagnating. That's how I describe this economy. It's stagnating. It's the worst economic recovery since the Great Depression. Now, I'm sure that the newscast tonight are not going to tell you all this. They're going to give you the great news. The unemployment rate hit a new low of 5.1%. Should we go out and have a party and cheer? No, we should not, because today's economy is not recovering like it should be. Normally, when you are in a recovery, you're expanding phase following a recession, especially one of this magnitude, you should be growing at 4, 5, 6% or higher, at least. at least that rate. Now, it doesn't mean you can sustain those rates over a long period of time, but you need to understand that the historical trend for economic growth of the U.S. economy over many decades is about 3.1, 3.2, some will say 3.3%. Depends on where you start and where you end. So you need somewhere in the neighborhood a little above 3% just to be on the long-range trend. But if you're recovering from a recession and the economy is really expanding, it should be growing at 4, 5, 6%. And if we were growing at 4, 5, 6%, we should be consistently month from month after month after month after month seeing 300, 400, 500 jobs being created. We haven't seen that. We've seen one or two over the entire period. But if you look at that chart, and that chart is that's the payoff chart. The message is right there. If I had a little bit more time, I'll put the growth rates in probably Tuesday, because I don't think I'm going to have much time if I'm trying to get posted the show. So I wanted to give you that context because you're not going to hear it on the news. Because most of these people are journalists, nothing against journalists, but they're not economists. And even some that are don't do their homework. And really all they're doing is read the government press release, in this case, telling you the highlights. And the highlight today will be the unemployment rate is 5.1%. It ticked down, edged down is how the BLS described it. Well, why did it edge down? Because people left the labor force. Hundreds of thousands of people have been leaving the labor force. That's not good, folks. It's not good at all. Now, I was noticing there were several revisions in both the June and July numbers. And the June and July numbers, and this was a preliminary, was at 245,000, which is better. But we're still nowhere near 300,000 consistently. And that's what we need. Now, why is the economy stagnating? Two words, government intervention. Government intervention in the economy. Where? First, the Obama stimulus package really didn't work. They never do, whether it's George Bush or Barack Obama. And then the impact of Obamacare on employment. It's been not very favorable. Why? See, in past recoveries, where you do have above trend line growth rates, most people that wanted full-time jobs could find them. Usually had more than one job offer. But because of Obamacare, a lot of employers simply are not hiring full-time people. They're hiring part-time people, and many of their full-time people they've made part-time, and by part-time I mean 30 hours or less. In some cases, 20 hours or less. I'm sitting on a college campus, and that's 20 hours or less is, if you're part-time, that's all they want you to work. Why? To save money. They don't have to pay into a retirement plan. They don't have to pay you medical benefits. So the dirty little secret on colleges today, including this one, but it's all over the place, is the part-time faculty, adjunct faculty, they go by various names. The road scholars is kind of a one way to describe it, because they're the commuting faculty. They're limited 20 hours a week. They can't work more than 20 hours a week. Now, if you're a full-time faculty, you can't, in other words, you probably are teaching three or four courses if you're on a community college. And there are fewer and fewer of those positions, by the way. They actually have been encouraging full-time faculty to retire. They're slowly but surely, it's not confined to this campus, it's almost in all community colleges as well as so-called senior universities. The percentage of part-time faculty typically is anywhere from 60 to 80%. It's obviously going to vary. In other words, if they couldn't hire part-time faculty, your son and daughter really couldn't get an education. They'd have to close down the colleges and universities across this country. Now, are they exploiting those people? Well, yes and no. Many of the people that are adjunct faculty have other jobs. And at one time, for example, I used to teach financial economics, this is a long time ago, in the mid-80s, at the University of Texas at Dallas. And I taught the course about four or five times. It's been a while. I had a full-time job, but I enjoy teaching. And I was in the financial services industry, and I knew this material and enjoyed teaching it. But then one day, the light bulb went on. They called me and they said, would you like to teach two sections? In other words, it's the same course, but you're going to teach two different groups, one in the morning, one in the evening. I said, okay, I could do that. Remember, this is during the summer. Normally, during the rest of the year, I would have said no. I would only take one. I simply didn't have the time. One was fine with me. So I said, yeah, I'll do that. And I found out, for at least that semester, I qualified for their medical plan and their retirement plan. Well, I had my own plan, so I didn't get involved in that. But I also knew the next semester, either I was not going to teach, and I ended up not teaching, because that was the semester I stopped it. Why? One day, I was in sales. I made more money in one day than I made that entire semester. And I asked myself, what's wrong with this picture? As much as I enjoy teaching, and I do enjoy teaching, especially this subject, financial economics, which deals with the various types of financial instruments, financial institutions, money, monetary theory, money and banking. I call it financial economics. Some call it financial markets. It has different titles, but it's more or less the same course. I made more money in an hour than I made all semester. And I said, you know, there's an opportunity course. That's the favorite word of economists. Everything has an opportunity cost. And I understand the concept of an opportunity cost. I said, you know, I have to stop teaching. Because if I apply the time and the effort that I put into this course, and this I think this was either the fourth or fifth time I taught the course. If I had spent that time doing my full-time job and focusing on that, I would have made a lot more money. So I stopped teaching. And I said, I'm never going to go back to it unless it's a full-time position. And the trend today in colleges is simple. It's away from full-time faculties. I know some of you parents are spending a lot of bucks sending your child to some senior university, but the odds are more like 60-40 or 70-30 that your daughter or son are being taught by a part-time faculty. I'm just giving you the big picture here. And usually the full-time faculty, even at a research university, such as where I was going, yes, the full-time faculty, the tenured faculty, would teach the lecture, but it was primarily grad students that were teaching the sections, because I used to teach some sections. So the university system, the college system in the United States, is largely today dominated by part-time faculty and graduate students teaching. Now, if you're a graduate student or someone that has a full-time job and likes, let's say, teaching one course, some even are more ambitious and teach two, that's fine with you. But there are people that truly would like to be full-time faculty. And I know some people in various fields that would jump at the chance of an opportunity to really get a full-time job, but they can't. They literally cannot. Now, what's made it even worse today is that's happening outside the university. That's why I was trying to give you this background, and I'm trying to relate it to the situation. Today in the job market, not all, but a lot of the jobs today are part-time jobs, less than 30 hours a week. Some are less than 20 hours a week. Depends on the job. Now, for many people, that's okay. They only want a part-time job. Let's say they're going to school. They only want a part-time job. I understand that. But for many other people, and I'm talking millions of people, they really need a full-time job. That's why many people today have two, in some cases three, part-time jobs. They can't find a permanent full-time job that pays well at all. And you're seeing that in the fact that the more and more people are leaving the labor force. Now, some economists will say, well, that's because the baby boomers are retiring. Well, I'm a baby boomer, and I'm on the leading edge of that baby boom. I don't think you can get further on the edge. I'm right on the edge of the baby boom generation. In other words, I'm the oldest of the baby boom generation. I'm looking to have a nationally syndicated talk radio show in the United States. And once I get my break, I plan to work another 10 or 20 years or maybe 30. I'm saying that because there are literally millions of people that would do that. And it's just not the baby boom generation. It's all generations. Because we have today an economy that's stagnating, primarily because of fundamentally flawed and wrong-headed fiscal policy, such as stimulus packages after stimulus packages and Obamacare. but also fundamentally wrong-headed monetary policy. As far as I'm concerned, and you need to understand this, the Federal Reserve Board consists, and the staff, they're primarily economists with PhDs that have gone to the best schools, the best, so-called best and brightest. Best, brightest, and well indoctrinated would probably be my description. And many of them went through the same graduate courses that I went through. I know that for a fact. Now, what's the problem? Most of these economists are biased. They're biased for government intervention. They think the Fed should be intervening in the economy and should be determining the federal funds rate. I do not agree. I think interest rates should be market determined. You see, what we have here is the remains or the remnant of a command and control economy where the government, in this case the Federal Reserve, the Central Bank of the United States, is trying to target or determine. They have a target rate. They instruct the Open Market Committee to try to hit a target of 25 basis points for the federal funds rate, the overnight rate that banks charge. They have kept it at that 25 basis point target since December of 2009. They call this unconventional monetary policy. Well, that's one way to describe it. I would call it clueless monetary policy because I don't think they know what they're doing. They think they do, and a lot of people are focusing in on them. You better believe it. I mean, if you, they're so-called Fed watchers. What is the Fed going to do? Are they going to raise the interest rate? When are they going to raise the interest rate? How high are they going to raise the interest rate? This is happening right now. And I sometimes play the game just for amusement. Will the Federal Reserve press the launch button and increase the federal funds rate? And then the next question is, by how much? Will it be in September? Will it be in October? Will it be in December? Investors would like to know. Like I said, I've said for many shows, they should have increased it slowly but surely by 25 basis points, quarter after quarter, several years ago. But they never, there's always a reason not to pull the trigger or press the button. Because they're government interventionists and they're afraid of two things. Causing another recession. That's the big one. But they don't want to pop an asset bubble. What's the asset bubble that they don't want to pop? It's the equity, the stock market. They don't want to take the rap. And they'll always find, they like to say they're data, we are data driven. I'm not sure what that, I've never understood what that means. I know they look at a lot of data and they have many reports and the staff briefs them and they get information from the presidents of the various districts. They never should have started this. And what I'm talking about is quantitative easing. There's two parts to this. I'm focusing right now on the federal funds target rate. And you see that in the chart. You see that long flat line starting in December 2009? That's more than unconventional. As long as that number is flat, that's what I call the clueless index. We don't have an exit strategy. We don't really know what we're doing, but we'll fake it and hope we get out of this mess. Several years ago, they should have started, at least 2 or 3 years ago minimum, started to gradually increase it to get back to a normal range. They're not doing it. Why are they not doing it? And that's the key point I'm getting to. Why have they not pulled the trigger or pressed that button? You got to cut through all the BS, all the press releases, the Federal Reserve, listening, whether it's Ben Bernanke, Alan Greenspan, and now Janet Yellen, cut through all that, and also cut through the myth that they're independent. That's the biggest lie, but that's, I'll get into that in a minute. What are they doing? What does this enable, this flat line? What it enables is massive debt. It enables the Democratic administration under Obama, with the help of Congress, to run massive deficits, initially of $1 trillion. Remember, $1 billion, $1 billion is $1,000 million. $1 trillion is $1,000 billion. That's what it'd be. And the whole economy typically is 17, 18 trillion. In other words, all the final goods and services that we produce in the entire United States is that? So we're talking a big number. Well, anyway, when Obama was first elected and they went with this huge stimulus package, the first year, the deficit was over $1,400 billion, $1.4 trillion. Next year is $1.3 trillion, and then slightly below $1.3 trillion. In other words, spending exceeded tax revenues by over $1 trillion. Now, what was happening? Why? What happens when you go in a recession, when you're laying off all those people? You're not collecting taxes. So tax revenues plummeted as a percentage of GDP. And that happens in every recession. So what happens is you run deficits, your spending are going to be considerably more than the tax revenues that have dramatically gone down, because when people are not working, they're not paying income taxes, they're not paying payroll tax. So total revenues take a hit. What you need to understand historically, if you add up all the taxes that the federal government collects, it's a little above 18%, about 18.2%, depending on what period of time, again, you start and end. But the government was, at that point, was approaching 25% of GDP in terms of spending. Now it's back down to around 20-21% range, somewhere in there. But what is the deficit going to be this year? And we'll know towards the end of October, it's going to be somewhere between 400 and 500 billion, which is good. That's at least half of, or a third of, what it was in the beginning of the Obama administration. But it's not a balanced budget. You see, if the government, if Congress and the president were fiscally responsible, they would have balanced budgets. In other words, they would spend what they collect in tax revenues. They haven't done it. The deficit year in, year out is in the hundreds of billions of dollars. That's fiscally irresponsible. I call it SAD, spending addiction disorder. And I'm telling you this because the key point is this. What is the core problem with the U.S. economy today? It's government spending is out of control, totally, completely out of control. Year in, year out, we're running massive debt. We cannot keep doing this, or we will end up by Greece sometime in the next 15 years. Maybe sooner. We just have to stop this. Now, what the Democratic Party thinks the answer is, more and more government spending. They are addicted to it. They have a very bad case of a spending addiction disorder. And what goes, their solution is, well, we need more government spending. We need more welfare programs. We need more entitlement programs. Less defense spending. And the answer is higher and higher tax rates. That doesn't work, but that's what they propose. No, that's not the answer. The answer is fundamentally cutting, and I mean real cuts in the budget. Most of those PhDs in the Fed, both at staff and the board, as well as in the White House. No, that's not the answer. The answer is another stimulus package, more and more taxes. And I've already heard it. We need another round of quantitative easing. We need to get this economy going. Quantitative easing is printing money. Now, they don't actually print it. They created it at a keyboard. But what are they doing? They're enabling to sell securities. Now, I need to emphasize this point. Right now, because of a recession in Europe, it looks like the Chinese are heading into one if they're not already in, and other economies around the globe, the fear is of a recession. You also have a lot of political instability in the Middle East, Northern Africa. You have hundreds of thousands, millions of people fleeing that. Long story short, capital is flying out of these countries into the United States. And where do they invest their money? In Treasury securities. So right now, the Fed doesn't have to buy Treasury securities. There are a lot of people just parking their money in Treasury securities and are happy with whatever they get in terms of yield. Now, that's hot money, and hot money comes in quickly and can go out quickly. You see, what the Fed has been doing initially during the recovery was enabling the federal government to run these massive deficits that they're still running. Now, they don't need as much support from the Fed for the simple reason you have a lot of money flowing in from other countries. See, in normal times, who invests in Treasury securities? Financial institutions, pension funds, insurance companies, capital management companies, individuals. And I'm talking Treasury bills, notes, and bonds. But this is not a normal situation. Interest rates on Treasury securities have been suppressed. In other words, they're not really determined by the market now, really since December of 2009. They should be 2 to 3% higher. Now, the Fed is not going to push those rates up much, if at all, as long as that hot money's coming into the United States. Why? It keeps the cost of our debt low. Every business day, what is the Fed doing? Not the Fed, the Treasury Department doing. They're selling, auctioning off new debt. Some of it is used to pay off the debt that's coming due in terms of its principal and interest. Other new debt is used to pay for the deficits the government is running. And it's still running between $400 and $500 billion. In other words, we're still spending too much money. We're living beyond the means of the American people. We're putting future generations, we're burdening them with a massive debt. This has to stop. Because as long as we have this unconventional monetary policy and this deficit spending of the Keynesians, and I don't have time to get into that. I'm looking at the clock. I'm going to have to wrap it up. I'm really pushing it. I'm surprised they haven't given me the signal. As long as we have the Federal Reserve Board that we have, as well as this administration, we are going to continue to run these massive deficits. Now, here's the problem. Does that mean if we have a Republican president and administration that it's going to be any better? I would say probably not. Why do I say that? What happened when George Bush was president? George W. Bush. He lives in Dallas, by the way, where I live. Different neighborhood. He ran massive deficits, too. Now, his didn't hit trillion, but were, you know, $100, $200, $300, $400 billion. And starting in 2007, the Democrats got control of the Congress, and then the deficits ballooned, spiked up. And I point that out because a lot of people like to blame Bush. Well, he was in control in 2007. Congress, the House and the Senate, but money bills must originate in the House. Now, the Senate and the House get together, agree on the bill. They control what those deficits are. They control tax bills and spending or appropriation bills. They ran up these massive deficits, hoping, although it never works, to stimulate the economy. Oh, we got out of recession, but the economy has been stagnating all along because we have a failed monetary policy and a failed fiscal policy. Fiscal policy deals with the budgets and taxes. Monetary policy deals with the money supply, but really what they're targeting is not the money supply, but interest rates. And this unconventional monetary policy of near zero interest rates, and that's why I led off with that chart. It did two or three things. One, it enabled the Department of Treasury to use the Federal Reserve as a buyer of first resort of their securities. The Fed also bailed out banks, bought their so-called trouble assets, and also bought mortgage-backed securities. Now, they've stopped that last year, but now there's talk of bringing it back because the economy is still stagnating, and the fear is we might be on the brink of a recession. We might be. I don't make predictions there because they're always going to be wrong, no matter who you are, because you cannot anticipate, for example, what the Federal Reserve is going to do. If you ask most economists, would you, if you went back to prior to this recession, could you envision the Federal Reserve keeping interest rates near zero, constant, for 6, 7, 8 years? No economist could envision that. And that's the point I'm trying to make. This is unconventional, is the term they like to call it. I call it the clueless. There is no exit strategy. You see, the Fed balance sheet went from a little over $800 billion. Last time I checked it, I think it was at $4.5 trillion. I think it's almost six times what it was before we had that financial crisis in 2008. We have what I call, or others have called also, the PhD standard. Now, my father, I was going for a PhD. And my father used to always kid me. He said, "Son, do you know what a PhD stands for?" I said, "Yeah, a doctorate of philosophy in this case, I was going in economics." "No, son, that's not what it stands for. PhD, pilot higher and deeper." And that is exactly what the Fed has done. It's piled it higher and deeper. Just look at their balance sheet. The assets on the balance sheet are the Treasury securities as well as the mortgage-backed securities that they bought. I think they might have some gold. I don't know. But it's primarily debt of the federal government as well as the banks that they bailed out. I think their exit strategy is very simple, and this, I think Ben Bernanke said this, well, we'll just keep the debt until it's finally retired. In other words, their balance sheet is going to be ballooned like that for many, 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 many years. While they stopped buying Treasury securities and mortgage-backed securities, they have not unwound that position of over $4 trillion, and they're not likely to do it. You see, they're running out of ideas. It used to be called they're pushing on a string. They've got themselves in this mess, and they don't know how to get out. But we entrust them to set the price of money in terms of the federal funds rate. Talk to anyone in the business, they'll say it's suppressed. If the market were really determining it, it'd be much higher across the board. Who does this hurt? And I'll have to wrap up the show here. Who does this really hurt? I've told you who it benefited. It benefit the government. It also benefit large corporations and the banks, financial institutions that can borrow at the low rate and make money on the spread as well as their investments. But who does it hurt? It hurts savers. Go into a bank today and see what interest rate they pay. It's not 1%, 2%, 3%. Yep, it's closer to zero. You see, the Federal Reserve is not independent. It's a creature of Congress, and it does Congress bidding. And the number one instructions were, you got to bail out. You got to be a buyer of Treasury securities. And that's what happened with quantitative easing 1, 2, and 3. And it's only a matter of time before we start 4. If the economy goes into a recession, I hope it's not, but it's more than a 50-50 proposition that it could. And one indication is commodity prices have fallen, gasoline prices are falling. Now, why does that typically happen? Because you have economies in recession, and when economies are in recession, what are they not doing? They're not buying raw materials. They're not buying commodities. There's a chart that I don't have here, but if you look at oil prices and then mark the period of time, usually with a shaded bar where the recessions are, invariably where you have oil, gasoline prices falling, and they're falling about time, usually that's where the recessions are. Like I said, I don't know if we're going in a recession. I think the Fed is going to pull the trigger. In other words, increase the federal funds rate 25 basis points. Do I think this is going to have any impact? No, I think the market has already discounted this. Consumers are not going to pay much attention to it. You see, the Fed doesn't know what to do. They don't have an exit strategy. They're flying by the seat of their pants. They say they're data-driven. Well, pilots will know this. If you're in bad weather, you're flying your instruments if you're instrument-rated. And you pay attention to your instruments, not your body. Well, they have a lot of data, but really they're flying by their seat of the pants. So to wrap it up and summarize, this was not really a good jobs report. At best, it's mediocre. And what's sad about this is now we're at 94 million. There's one other thing that was sad. I was reading some report that the full employment number is 5.1 to 5.4. I said, huh? When I was going to school, I'm really dating myself, full employment was under 3%. My, oh my, how have we... The standards have fallen. I don't consider 5% or 5.1% full employment. At that rate, according to the government statistics, there are 8 million people unemployed. But really, the story is in the 94 million Americans not in the labor force. At least 10 to 20 million would take a job. They are truly still unemployed. But after many weeks, months, or years looking for a job, they haven't been able to find it. They finally have left. They'll come back. If we had a booming economy, what happens? Two things happen. One is the people that are now sitting it out, not in the labor force, come back, and the labor participation rate shoots up. The normal labor participation rate is between 66 and 67%. We've had those numbers in the Clinton administration and the early years of the Bush administration. That's where the labor participation rate should be. And if we have a growing, prosperous economy, that is what you should expect. Labor participation rates between 66 and 67%, and I would argue even higher. What is the labor participation rate today? It's 62.6%. That's a 38-year low. Now, over time, the labor participation rate goes up, but it's been stuck at very low rates, which is not good and reflects the fact we have a stagnating economy that's growing in a good quarter between 2 and 2.5%. The bottom line is, to get a booming economy, we need the right economic incentives. We need the right tax system. As long as we continue with the income tax system, we're going to get these numbers. That's part of the problem. The other is, by far, that government spending is simply out of control. Until we control our spending, until we reform our tax system and go from an income-based system to a broad-based consumption tax, such as the fair tax, we're never going to see growth rates of 5, 6, 7, 8% again. In other words, government intervention, both on the fiscal side in terms of taxes and spending, and on the monetary side in terms of interest rates and intervening, are messing up this economy. They are the problem. Look in the mirror, Janet Yellen. Look in the mirror, President Obama. Look in the mirror, the leadership of both the Democrat and Republican Party in the House and Senate. You're the problem. You're spending more than the American people can support a government. And the problem is always what brings down and leads to ultimately the default of Treasury securities will be out of control spending. We have a limited amount of time to turn this economy around and go in a new direction. And the only candidate so far, and he's still being a little cagey, that could do this is Donald Trump. And I don't know what his tax policy is. I know he wants to simplify it, lower tax rates, remove the burden of taxation on the middle class, but I don't know if he's going to be just another one of these, I call them tweakers of the tax system, that's not the answer, or whether or not he's going to come out for a consumption tax. And even if he comes out for it, he's going to have a battle royal with the status quo and the establishment of both political parties. We'll fight him tooth and nail to go from an income tax system to a consumption tax system such as the fair tax that there are supporters of. I think there are over 70 or 80 congressmen and senators, but that's simply not enough. We need a leader that understands this, understands we got to get the economy moving again, growing at higher interest rates, and one of the biggest impediments is our tax system, as well as this incompetent monetary policy. Yeah, I'm for abolishing the Fed, and that's another show, for the simple reason, the primary reason for any central bank, including the Federal Reserve, besides being a lender of last resort, the primary reason that they, and their goal, their mission should be price stability. They have been total, complete failures in that regard. A $19.14 dollar, and that's when they started business, is now worth less than 3 cents. That's failure, folks. That's not price stability. If we had price stability, a $19.14 dollar today would be worth a dollar. It's not worth a dollar. It's worth 3 cents. It's called inflation. Inflation is fundamentally a monetary policy. I'm looking at the time. I'm a little bit over, and I know they're going to throw me out any minute or close down the studio. And I wish I had more time because I could at least use another half hour. But I wanted to get across that we need some fundamental change here. We can't continue muddling through, because if we continue doing this year after year, we will be Greece. We're not Greece yet, but we're sure going at a rather rapid pace to be Greece in 2030. And I don't want that to happen. I want to wish everybody a happy, relaxing Labor Day weekend. And to start your Labor Day weekend on a good start, I want to play America the Beautiful. My name is Raymond Thomas Pronk, the presenter of the Pronk Pop Show. Views expressed on this show are my own, unless otherwise stated, and do not reflect the opinion of KDUX Web Radio, Richland College, or the Dallas County Community College District. You are listening to KDUX Web Radio, broadcasting live from Richland College in Dallas, Texas, with a voice of Richland College. You are listening to the Pronk Pop Show, presented by Raymond Thomas Pronk, the People's Paladin Pronk, propagating faith, family, friends, freedom first. Broadcasted by Renaissance Radio, Radiating Reason, and KDUX Web Radio. Podcasted by PronkPops.wordpress.com and KDUX Web Radio.wordpress.com.